Hello and welcome to C2Y Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care. Today I'm speaking with Sally Doulas. Sally Doulas is a registered social worker with post-academic training in intensive child psychotherapy, marital therapy, and emotion-focused therapy for couples with emotional injury, parent-infant psychotherapy, and high conflict in custody disputes. Sally has served as president of the Toronto Child Psychoanalytic Program, where she continues to be on faculty and is a supervisor. Sally has worked in the field of children's mental health as a therapist, supervisor, and teacher for over 35 years. She has served as head of the Individual Psychotherapy Program at the CM Hinks Treatment Center. She currently has a private practice providing individual, child, adolescent, and adult psychotherapy, infant, parent psychotherapy with the under fives and their families, marital therapy, counseling to divorcing families, family therapy for reconnecting a child with a parent, and custody access assessment through the Office of the Children's Lawyer. Wow, you do a lot, Sally.
Thank you, yes. But I also wish to mention that I'm also going to be speaking today from the work that I do at the Hinks Delcrest Center. Just noticed the name has changed because they merged several years ago. I am no longer on staff at the Hinks Delcrest, but I have a contract position where I work on one of the infant teams one half day a week, which is a clinical teaching situation where we meet with the families and teach individuals who are wanting to learn the method of working with infants and parents. Now, I do do some workshops with my colleague, Elizabeth Tudors, who I work with on this infant team, and also use Susan Yabsley, who is the chief psychologist and head of the infant programs at the Hinks Delcrest Center. So I mention that because most of what we're going to be talking about today comes from my work with these individuals.
Thank you very much for clarifying that.
Sure.
And what I want to talk with you today is about that work, with particularly with infants, young children, and parents, as it relates to something called attachment and attachment theory. Over the past several podcasts, we've been talking about youth-related issues, much more so than children-related issues. And I've been wanting to speak more about working with children, and given your experience working particularly with really young children and their families, I thought he would be a great person to speak with.
Thank you.
So attachment theories, it's something that's been written about, you know, at least since the 50s, when started with the work of John Bowlby. And it's now widely discussed as it relates to working with children. So I thought maybe we could begin with a bit of an overview of what exactly attachment theory is. People break it down to secure and insecure attachment. Could you start by explaining what these terms mean?
Sure, it's a good place to start. And I think you've come at a very opportune time to talk about attachment and the development of relationships when several disciplines are converging to produce a new understanding of emotional life. The advances in neuroscience, psychology, psychoanalysis, and biochemistry are all happening right now. As a result, there's a fuller understanding of human development, which has deepened and includes how humans learn to relate emotionally to one another. The knowledge of human infancy we have attained is at the center of understanding emotional life. Emotion is the core, the central core of attachment theory, and I really want to stress that. Much attention has been paid to our cognitive experiences, while our emotional experiences have been less emphasized. Emotions, though, are crucial to survival. In fact, feelings come first, as our rationality is built on emotion and cannot exist without it. The complexity of being human is that we have, I think it's helpful to say, we have two selves. The emotional, experiential, sensory stream of consciousness is one, and the rational, cognitive stream of consciousness. Becoming aware of feelings is a first step in knowing oneself and then in problem solving. When we become aware of our feelings, we see our own patterns of emotional response, which helps us to gain perspective and to control our emotional reactions. Changing our cognitions, then, helps us to regulate our feeling states. John Bowlby said right from the beginning that the attachment bond between a mother and an infant is an emotional bond, and not just a sharing of cognitive information. So I really want to emphasize the emotional piece first and foremost.
So with the emotional piece, does attachment theory say that infants right from birth have an emotional relationship with their caregivers?
Absolutely. And not only at birth, but I'll talk a bit about prenatal, in the womb, the minute the child is conceived.
So prior to birth.
Prior to birth.
Please.
Yes. Okay. So to put it succinctly, attachment is about staying alive. I don't know if you've read anything by Pat Crittenden, but she starts out with, it's all about staying alive, which is quite unique. In infancy and childhood, attachment figures provide protection, safety, and teach children how to make meaning of their own experience and the experience of others. Attachment theory is about relationships. That's the main event. It's a pattern of a specific relationship, a self-protective strategy, and a pattern of information processing. From infancy, humans develop self-protective strategies which are either secure and balanced, which is the integration of positive and negative affect, and predictable behavior, or insecure, avoidant, avoidance of intense affects, primarily negative affects, but still can be predictable behavior, or insecure, ambivalent, resistant, where there is intense affect but unpredictable behavior. Now, there's also the disorganized, but that's more complicated, so I'll save a little bit late for later on that. To give some history, John Bowlby, the father of attachment theory and a psychoanalyst, became aware of the evidence from animal studies of Conrad Lorenz and Harry Harlow. This was back in, Lorenz was in the 30s, and Harlow was in the 50s. And combined theories from evolutionary biology, ethology, developmental psychology, and cognitive science, which led to a biological basis for attachment theory. My, he did a lot, really.
Bowlby did a lot.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The proximity to one's caregiver is thought to give survival advantage in the protection of the child from predators. And an affectional bond with a caregiver becomes an attachment bond when the individual seeks security or comfort from the relationship.
So anytime a child reaches out to his or her primary caregiver, that's reforming or enhancing the attachment connection.
Exactly. And when the child reaches out, because usually, well, in the most important sense, in times of stress, right, when the child is upset or ill, feeling something emotional, And this is where the most important matter happens between how the parent responds, is in those moments of distress. That's where the child will feel secure or insecure.
So it's not just being present for the child and picking the child up and comforting the child. It's when the child is in stress or de-stress.
Yes.
And responding and reacting to that, the
exactly.
child recognizes, in those stressful moments, there's somebody there to care
well,
for me.
Well, they begin to believe that someone will be there for them. And that is critical.
Right.
Yeah.
And if someone's not there, then they don't have that sense that somebody is there for them. And that's when we start to see the insecure attachments.
That's right. And then what happens is they begin to believe that someone reaching out and helping them with their feelings at that moment will not be there, so then they shut down. Right. They stop asking.
Right.
And that is the beginning of the development of an avoidant attachment.
Right. When do we start to see the attachment? You said right prenatal, but when do we start to see that reaching out in response having an impact on the infant and the child?
Well, right from day one, for sure. But okay. Attachment isn't really set until sometime in the first year. But at age one, attachment can be measured. And then you can determine what kind of attachment is this. So again, what in terms of the affectional bond and the attachment relationship, what is of utmost importance in ongoing interactions between the infant child and caregiver is the quality of the caregiver's emotional response when the infant child seeks security or comfort during times of stress or distress, which contributes to the development of a secure base.
So the caregiver needs to be emotionally connected as well. So it's not just picking the child up and
thinking,
and tweeting at the same time. He's picking the child up and being emotionally in relationship with the child in those moments of distress.
Absolutely. Let me give you an example. So if the parent is attuned to the emotional reaction the child is needing at the moment, then they can comfort and soothe that child and let the child feel that the world is okay. Now, if they're not attuned and they only administer to the physical, instrumental, oh, the child just needs a diaper change, oh, the child just wants to be fed, but not really understanding that the child needs the parent's soft, kind, calm look in their face, tone in their voice. They may pick up the child in a harsh, oh, what do you want now? And administer instrumentally. Then that's not going to aid the child's secure development.
Right. And you're saying that a child's as young as 2, 3, 5, 6 months can tell the emotional state of the parent?
Earlier than that. Right from the start. The child is wired into his or her sensory state. Touch, sound, everything.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, that's how we survive. If you think about the animal kingdom, how do they survive?
Right, being able to read the cues and understand the emotional. Is the predator a danger? Is the predator okay? Is it prey, not a predator at all? Is it frightened?
Exactly. When the little animal sees a snake in front of it, it's going to look at its mother to see, do I have to be worried about this or not?
Right. And so understanding the emotional cues allows us to stay alive.
Exactly, yeah. The caregiver needs to be a secure base so the child develops an emotional security.
Right.
Not all children are securely attached, although in the research, about 60 to 75% of the population are said to be securely attached, which I think is good news.
It sounds like great news. In your experience, well, you're a therapist, so you probably don't see that 60%.
Exactly. Because the situations that come to a clinic, they're having troubles. But we know that we can be helpful.
Right.
And that we can take an insecure situation and make it secure and more secure. And then they can go on. And that's why I love working with really young situations, young children.
Right.
Because you have a chance to change the course of development.
Right.
So a secure pattern occurs when a child has a mental representation of the attachment figure as emotionally available and responsive when needed. That's what we've been talking about.
Right, yes.
Infants are considered to be insecurely attached when they lack such representation. Insecure attachments are classified as either avoidant, ambivalent, resistant, or disorganized, disoriented. So now, do you want me to go on to talk about what ingredients go into developing a secure attachment?
That would be great. And I'd like you to take that from two perspectives. One perspective is for a parent, right? How does a parent develop a secure attachment with a child? And the other perspective is as the clinician or as a child and youth worker, someone who works with children and families, how do we help reconnect that relationship? So let's start with a parent. How does a parent build a secure connection with a child?
Well, they certainly are going to be influenced from their own past attachment relationships,
so,
for sure.
So what their experience is as a child will then inform how they parent.
Exactly. Or they may do the opposite. You know, if they have some insight about what's happened to them and they have experienced a difficult attachment relationship and they have some insecurities, but maybe they've gotten some, they've been interested to do some self-discovery, they've learned something on their own, or they certainly have understood their own feelings and they know what they don't want to be doing. That can, people on their own can get there.
Right. So it doesn't require intervention at year one, year two. An adult who recognizes, or a young person who recognizes these concerns, identifies these, can do things on their own to shift how they parent and their own attachment style.
Yes. But if not, an attachment style will most often be repeated.
Right, right. So how does one build a secure attachment with a child as a parent?
Okay, so a secure child-parent relationship is characterized as a loving relationship where the infant child uses the caregiver as a secure base from which to explore, shows affective sharing with the caregiver. So this is from the infant to the parent.
Right.
They use the parent. They access the parent. But they're all the time believing that that parent is going to be emotionally attuned and responsive to them. They may or may not be upset at separations. They show little or no resistance to interactions. They explore toys in the room. They seek proximity after separation with the caregiver. They calm down quickly after the caregiver returns, and they explore again within 3 minutes. Right. That's a secure child.
So that's what a secure child looks like when they're in these situations.
Exactly. And the caregiver parent patterns that contribute, so this is maybe in answering your question, that contribute to the patterns of attachment are in general. I would say what the patterns are in general, the secure and insecure, and then I'll say what happens in the secure attachment.
Excellent.
So what a caregiver needs to be doing is be sensitive versus insensitive. And that's emotionally sensitive versus insensitive.
And that goes back to the idea that when the child in distress, the caregiver recognizes that, the caregiver responds to that, the caregiver is empathetic with the child in how they're responding to it.
Yes. They are accepting versus rejecting.
Right. So when the child's crying, they're not locking the child in the room to work it out and cry himself out. They pick the child up and soothe her.
That's correct. Yes, and that's a very interesting different way of being with children.
Mm-hmm.
The behavioral versus the emotional empathic.
Yes. And it's intriguing because one can argue that the result of both on behavior is the same. The child will stop crying either way with that. And what you're saying, attachment theory claims that emotionally the option of letting the child cry it out and learn that they have to work through these difficult situations ultimately has a negative impact on the child.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So the parent needing to be accessible, emotionally acceptable, versus being ignoring or neglectful, which is what you were just raising. Cooperation versus interference. Comforting the child, particularly when hurt, frightened, or ill. Accepting feelings, such as anger, jealousy, sadness, and fear. That's an important one because some parents have a lot of difficulty accepting the negative emotions because of their own parent having not been able to accept their negative experiences. And these are the children who, you've heard of the ghosts in the nursery, the children whose cries have not been heard.
Right. And so a parent, in order to build that attachment relationship, so it's reciprocal, the child, the parent, the child, or the caregiver, the child, they need to not reject the child when the child lashes out and says, "I hate you, mommy." When the child is really upset and cries, they need to still be there, even though the child...
And throwing things and screaming and hitting the parent, all of those things. The parent needs to find a way to stay calm themselves so that the child... This is affect regulation. So that the child can calm down. Mm. And it's at that moment when parents start trying to teach something, it's never going to work.
Right.
Because you can't put into place cognitive thoughts and working through things until the emotion is calmed down.
Right, right. This is a big controversy with attachment theory and what's being, I think, perhaps mistermed attachment parenting. But there's a big argument that children need to learn that they can't always get everything they want. And that goes through a long line of history. And does that contradict attachment theory?
I don't think so, because I think what my experience has been is if parents are... there's an approach called time in rather than time out, which is the opposite of, you know, separating the child, go to your room, you've been bad, you work it out. Time in is staying with the child, talking about the experience, what was happening to you, calming them down and saying, we're going to take some time to calm ourselves down. I'm going to go and make dinner and you can sit in the kitchen with me and be calming yourself down. Maybe you would like a hot chocolate while we're thinking about this. And then coming back to, but you don't remove yourself necessarily.
Right.
And you don't, because children especially, I can say, using time out with adopted children can be especially difficult because they are very susceptible to fear of abandonment. But I find that if parents are able to use this more emotional method of working with, as Dan Siegel calls, the right brain versus the left brain, calming the right brain and then working with the left brain later on, then you rarely even have to discipline children.
And just that emotional regulation, that time in, that love being present, the child having that secure base, that in and of itself will calm the child down and help them to develop and learn appropriate behaviors.
Exactly. Because the parent is taking time, they're giving the impression to the child that they have a separate mind, they have a separate experience. There's you and there's me. And you may be feeling this right now, but I can let you know that, it's not the end of the world and you're going to get over this. And together, we're going to calm things down and you're going to feel better.
Right.
So use the strength of what I can give you, child, to settle you.
Right.
And you know, believe and trust that I'm going to help you with this. Versus when a parent says, go to your room and work it out yourself. Does that child really have the tools at the moment to settle themselves? They're going to struggle to find ways, but it's going to create a lot of stress. So a lot of cortisol is going to be happening at that moment. And that gets into the brain patterns. And that's what's so hard to change. We know that it can be changed now, but it requires a lot of work. So again, accepting feelings, negative feelings as well as positive, and actually talking about all kinds of feelings. That's how children learn what do I feel right now? How else are they going to learn? But you have to, as a parent, be able to speak about your own feelings. Mm-hmm. So, and being careful not to overwhelm the child by being too intrusive or too direct. Because, you know, they're just little. So you want to know how much to say and at their developmental age. So knowing and learning about development is really important.
Right.
And there's a lot written about it. So, you know, there's some great websites. 0 to 3 is a great one for parents to go on to.
And the work you're talking about right now as a parent with a child, you are talking about that age period from what you're talking prenatal, so from conception until about 3 years old is the...
Well, no, I'm talking more of 3 to 5, but, you know, all of what I'm talking about right now starts right from the beginning, so yes. And then the last pattern that contributes to attachment patterns is expressing with words genuine joy and love.
That the caregiver expresses with words, genuine.
Yeah, yeah. With words and with facial expressions, with tone of voice, all of that is very, very important. You know, if you're expressing, of course I love you. Why would you even be asking? That's not really expressing love and joy for that child. That's sort of with the tone of resentment. And maybe the parent is overly stressed at the moment. I mean, parents have a life too. So, you know, this is really hard work. And you don't want to give parents the sense that they can't do it. You know, I mean, most parents do it. And
60%.
Yeah, exactly. It's just to emphasize how important it is and actually give parents some good positive regard for all of the hard work that they do. That's really important.
Yes, it seems like incredibly hard work.
It is, yeah. So, what do these patterns look like? A secure attachment pattern reflects an internal working model that gets put into the mind of the child, characterized by confidence that the caregiver will be emotionally comforting, available, responsive to their needs, and predictable. That's a very important word. An insecure, avoidant pattern is characterized by a rejecting quality, where the caregiver ignores negative emotions, consistently fails to respond when the child is upset or crying, may be hostile, ignoring, intrusive, controlling, or rejecting, tends to be insensitive, and does not read cues appropriately related to neediness, and is less comfortable with close physical contact.
So the parent's own discomfort with physical contact or its own understanding and emotional regulation then gets passed on to the child.
Exactly. And it's their own belief that relationships are important because of what happened to them in the past.
So that saying that we sometimes hear, I don't need anybody, I'm my own person, you know, I've survived, those sorts of beliefs, those sorts of that sort of an emotional response will then be passed on to the child, which says, I don't need you, to the child, and the child then no longer has that secure base.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, and that is avoidant, and that parent becomes dismissing of the relationship because that's what happened to them from their parent.
Right.
And an insecure, ambivalent, resistant pattern is different still. It's characterized by an inconsistent quality where the caregiver is highly anxious, overprotective, interfering, inconsistent, and passive, unresponsive, and ineffectual. So these parents are very preoccupied with issues from the past for themselves. And relationships matter to them, but they don't feel that they've gotten what they've needed. So their unmet needs drive them to create that kind of pattern, constantly trying to get what they didn't get.
It seems to me that many parents who want to build an attachment with their child, that seems like an appropriate profile in many respects, in that they want to be there for the child, they want to reach out, they want to support, they want to help, they're anxious not to help the child. Why would that not be a helpful thing to build attachment?
Well, it depends on how present they are, how intrusive they might be, how consistent. Like some parents with insecure, ambivalent, resistant attachments, sometimes they do exactly what's needed. But it's the fact that they're not consistent. And then there are the times when they don't. So then the child can't develop a sense of, I know that every time I need something, my parent's going to act according to my needs.
Right.
They may not, and maybe it'll be awful.
Right.
So maybe I better just stop needing.
So, because they don't,
and meet my own needs.
Right.
That's what the child does.
Right. Because they don't understand how, they don't know, they can't predict how the parent's going to react.
That's
the
right.
Parent might be really appropriate and responsive and loving. The parent might be absent. Mm-hmm. The parent might not respond at all. The parent, right. When the child's, you know, done something before they've decided how they're going to react, or before they're aware of their emotion, the parent swoops in. So there's no sense of the child being able to self-regulate.
That's correct. And this happens a lot with depressed parents. Which the parent is, because they're dealing with their own emotional needs, they're depressed and they're not able. That's a good example of that kind of situation.
We often talk about, in child and youth care, we often talk about parenting that is indulgent. So there's a high level of warmth, but a low level of control. And it sounds like there's some similarities there, where there's a desire to help the child and the parent wants to help the child, but the parent doesn't know how to help the child.
Yeah. And so maybe those children who are indulged, it's a form of neglect, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they're not meeting the child's need. Children, right. It may be easier to indulge.
Right.
I'll just give you lots of money, go out and buy what you want. But are they really involved with the child? Are they teaching that child how to think about their emotions, how to plan and problem solve? Maybe not.
Right.
So, and then finally, the last really difficult category. I won't say a lot about it because there are volumes written about it. The disorganized, disoriented pattern is characterized by an atypical quality where the caregiver has been unpredictable, appeared frightened or frightening, and exhibits hostility and anger. And here the infant can't really develop a clear pattern. So they have no pattern of relating, and that is really disturbing.
So would that be analogous to a very authoritarian type of parent, and that it's very controlling, but it's but there could be a predictability with that.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
We think that talking about what the problems are and using your own mind and the child's mind, that's the best form of parenting.
Mm-hmm.
Not the hierarchical,
right.
Top-down, working with, negotiating, because you're giving the child a sense that they are important and they have a mind and they can have some input. They may not be making the final decision, but they need to be heard.
And that, of course, depends on where they are developmentally. So the older the child gets, the more they're part of that decision-making
process.
That's correct,
yeah.
So you've talked about the importance of secure attachment. What happens if the child's not securely attached? So what do we see, and what are the problems with that?
Well, they're going to develop strategies the avoidant or the resistant strategies that are going to become personality disorders, perhaps, or some continuum, because these are ways of regulating emotion. And they're going to have difficulties in their relationships going forward.
Right. And so if they do not have that secure attachment and they don't, you know, there's not opportunities to work on that, mm-hmm. Then they're going to see that in their relationship patterns, in their personality yeah. development, in how they move forward for the world, and it's going to negatively impact them in,
that's correct.
In all those. And then ultimately, if they decide to have children themselves, mm-hmm. it'll
and
impact
then it'll be repeated.
Right.
Yeah.
And is there... has there been research done looking at things like criminogenic behavior and attachment patterns, things like acting out behaviors and attachment patterns, things like relationship stability, longevity, and attachment patterns?
Well, there's been lots of research, but I'm not going to quote all of that. There's a book I was just looking at today written by Sue Gerhardt, Why Love Matters. And she goes into a lot of that in terms of some of the research that has been done with antisocial behaviors. So there's a lot to read out there. But let me tell you about the contributions of neuroscience, because maybe that'll also click into what you're asking. Dr. Alan Shore, a renowned scientist and clinical neuropsychologist, recently quoted in one of the journals that I read, the Family Court Review. They had a whole journal about attachment theory, which was really quite stunning. And he said that in the last 15 years, two major trends of research have converged to confirm the basic tenets of interpersonal neurobiology, from psychology, as opposed to earlier models, that posited the beginnings of personality between the third and fourth year. There is now good evidence that the prenatal and postnatal stages of human infancy represent the critical period.
So from conception, to birth, that's
right.
A critical period.
Yes, yes, prenatally, right. Interesting to find that out. And that's for the organization of the central dimensions of the personality. And from neuroscience, the peak interval of attachment formation overlaps the most rapid period of massive human brain growth. It takes place from the last trimester of pregnancy through to the end of the third year. So it's very early.
Mm-hmm.
And he continues stating that we also now know that attachment does more than provide the infant with a sense of safety and security. Rather, attachment drives brain development. 5/6 of what happens postnatally, and it is influenced by social forces. So this strengthens the whole idea of the relationship is the most important factor.
And if the child doesn't have that relationship starting from conception, that it will negatively impact the child's brain development.
Exactly. Very much so. It is experience dependent what happens to the brain. That is, emotional experiences embedded in the relationship it co-creates with the primary caregiver. That's how brain development happens.
So the caregiver provides that secure attachment, that love, that mm-hmm. relationship between the two, that allows the child to grow not only emotionally, but cognitively and physiologically in a way that's going to foster health.
Exactly. You've really got it. Yeah, that's nice. Another unique finding is that there is now strong evidence that the secure primary attachment figure not only downregulates negative emotional states of the baby, calming and soothing, but also upregulates positive emotions in play states. They stimulate states of joy and excitement,
right,
and
so,
interest.
So the parent interacting with the child, mm-hmm. the primary caregiver interacting with the child, will allow the child to express happiness and joy and exactly. have that full range of anger and fear
exactly.
And disquiet to joy and happiness.
Right, right. And so in my work, the use of play is critical. That's what we use to help the parents to... And some children, when they first come, they can't play. And when they can't play, you know that something's really gone wrong in that relationship.
What do you mean they can't play?
They can take... They don't. They look at the toys, they don't know what to do with them. They may take an animal out of the box, and then they sit there, they don't know what to do with it. They may take another animal out. They may be able to line them up a little bit, but they don't know how to say, oh, the animal is having a birthday party, and they want to invite their friends, and let's get the friends out, and where are the mommy and daddy, and you be the mommy, and I'll be the daddy. They can't do any of that.
And that's because that during those formative times, They weren't taught that, or they weren't allowed the space for that. Why would a child not be able to play?
All of those things. And they're not secure in the relationship. Their synapses aren't firing in a way that they can do it. So that's what we have to correct in right. the treatment that we right. do. Let me just say that in the play, the end result being that the child develops the ability to emotionally communicate feeling states. Okay, so they can't do that, right?
Yeah.
And needs to be able to regulate positive and negative emotional feeling states. And both are components of healthy self-esteem, right?
Right.
So
do you have a sense of how we start to work prenatally? I mean, so much of the stuff when we talk about prenatal work is around, you know, folic acid and healthy diet and appropriate exercise.
Mm-hmm.
How do we build attachment before the child is delivered?
Well, you know, a lot depends on the mother, especially her mental state. During that period of time. Is this a wanted, a planned baby or not? How much does that mother connect up to that developing child inside of her? Is she feeling positive and good about that baby? Is she beginning to talk to that baby in utero? Touch, looking... the fetus can feel all those things. That's what we know now. We had one family come where the child was 7 months old, and they came because they couldn't put this baby to sleep. And both parents, and these were really talented, good, caring parents, who absolutely loved their child, wanted their child, but couldn't put her to sleep, and they were becoming exhausted. This was going on for 7 months. The child had developed a rash at one point, and that made the baby had been sleeping initially, but had been sleeping, and then she couldn't sleep because they had to keep waking her up. So that interfered with the sleep process for sure. But going back and looking at the history, the mother had been very, very anxious right from conception, because she worried about sudden infant death. She had known about it. She had lost a friend. I mean, there were several incidences that really troubled her. Her mother was highly anxious. She was a highly anxious person at the time. All of that affects the fetus. So once she started to realize the baby can go to sleep, the mother was having a lot of difficulty with the separation herself, putting the baby to bed at night, and that created a separation. Well, she had also had a very troubling experience with separation from her own mother. So all of these things were in her mind, which were inhibiting her ability to actually feel that separation is not a disaster. It can actually be a positive experience. So, you know, working with that family for, about 18 sessions, at the end of it all, I mean, her baby was sleeping through the night, she was sleeping through the night, she was able to go back to work, and so, all was well in
so
that
was
household.
That's nice, because knowing several new parents,
yeah.
The lack of sleep is impactful.
Oh, it's pretty bad. And lack of sleep, we know, is one of the worst things, especially if people are depressed.
Yes.
And then they still can't sleep. I mean, that is really trauma. Yeah.
So sure. with that family that you worked with, was it that the mother was going back in and disturbing the child who was sleeping, or was it that as the mother left, the mother was so anxious, the child started to pick up on the emotional state of the mother?
The latter, yeah. Because both parents were working very hard. I mean, I can't tell you the regime that they had going. Oh, my God. Breastfeeding until hopefully she fell asleep, sitting in the rocking chair, putting on the music, having her sleep in the bed with both parents. Dad would get up and go in. Mom would get up and go in. Well, you know, you saw a little bit of that with the when the bow breaks. There were two infant sleep problems. You remember those cases?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Certainly.
Yeah. Well, those were children with sleep problems. You saw that what was happening with, I'd say primarily the mothers in those cases, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in those cases, one of the interfering factors was the first child that they had a relationship with. And somehow they weren't really connecting yet up with their new infant.
Yeah.
And once they were able to see that baby and connect up with who that baby was, you saw the joy that happened inside the mother when that one mother, Callum, I think his name, when she finally realized, oh my God, I never connected up with him. I never saw him. I was so busy with my other child. I mean, it was beautiful the way, and it happened pretty quickly, didn't it?
It did. Just for listeners, When the Bow Breaks was a CBC, I think it was a Fifth Estate show that was actually filmed at the Hinks and follows three families who do therapy at the Hinks around attachment issues. And was one of the first, I would say, one of the first movies that really, or TV shows, that really started to help me think through attachment and what is attachment. One of the responses I often, I would show it in my classes, the students would often say, does play therapy really work? What's your answer to that, Sally?
Oh my gosh, play therapy is, well, play in general. I mean, I give young parents literature about the importance of play. In fact, I give it to clients when we're starting to work with them. One thing you're going to need to learn about is, you know, they'll say to us, well, I get down on the floor, and because it's important to get down on the floor with the child and play with them. I do that at home, really. Well, maybe not in quite the way that we're going to be helping you to play in a different way, in a more emotional way. So, you know, we have to teach them what to look for. What do you think when your child is grabbing that doctor's kit and listening to your heart, what do you think is in the mind of that child? Why did that child take the doctor's kit right now rather than the animals or the trains and the tracks? Why is that child connecting up the tracks here when they're trying to find their connection to you? What do you think that's all about? Mm-hmm. So play is very important in answer to your question. And play therapy can be really helpful when a child needs individual work, because they can work through their conflicts through play.
We're actually going to have, shortly, we're going to have someone from the Canadian Association of Play Therapists to come on the show to talk a bit more about play therapy in a bit more depth than I...
Right.
One of the reasons I wanted to do attachment first was that we had a bit of a foundation of how to build on that.
Well, that should follow very nicely.
Yes, hopefully.
Let me just finish one more piece of this,
please.
Because I think you're going to get to when things go wrong, then what? So we now know from the revolutionary brain research, and some of you may have read Norman Doidge's book, The Brain That Changes Itself. Absolutely mind-boggling
book. Excellent book,
right? that the brain's neuroplasticity gives it the ability to change itself, its own structure and its function, through thought and activity. The plastic paradox, though, that he talks about, is that our brains are vulnerable, first of all, to negative influences, outside influences, which we've been talking about. And some of our most stubborn habits and disorders are products of our plasticity. And this is where trauma gets put into our brains. The positive news is that with new relationship experiences in the here and now, new brain connections can be created, and past unresolved emotional experiences and or impaired parenting patterns can be corrected by internal understanding and encouraging healthy, attuned, predictable relationship interactions which lead to integration. And that's really, and this some of this comes from Dan Siegel, another book of his, Parenting from the Inside Out. Have you seen that?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Have you seen his new book, The Whole Brain Child?
I've seen it, but last I looked, it hadn't been out yet. So maybe is it out now?
Oh, definitely.
Oh, yeah?
I've never had a book that I've given to parents where they've come back and said, this is changing my life. This is very helpful. And what they realize is, I've got to change. I'm doing it all wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe just as we start to move towards wrapping this up, Sally, one of the things that has struck me a bit as we've been talking is the sense of primary caregiver mother, and there's a disquiet that I'm having that... is the natural progression from this saying it's all the mother's fault if there's any problems with the child?
Of course not. No. And we don't want to be blaming parents, because fathers have a very important role too. I think we start with the primary relationship because the child is a part of the mother's body. But nowadays, I mean, we do also know that children can develop lots of attachment relationships. There's no such thing anymore about... I mean, some people still talk about their child will choose a primary. I don't know that I believe that from what I've seen. Hmm. Especially in families where the fathers are equally involved, emotionally attuned, sensitive, I'm finding that the child can access either parent. And, you know, if you ask them, who would you go to in times of stress? And I do that a lot in my assessment interviews, in custody access and otherwise. These children, without either parent in the room, will say, either parent. Mm. So how would your dad react if you went to your dad in such and such a circumstance? Well, dad would do this, blah, 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 blah. And how would your mom react? Mom would do... pretty much the same, blah, 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 blah. Maybe a little bit different. They each have a different style. But what do you feel when each of your parent responds in the way that they do? I feel comfortable. I feel helped. It's helped me. So, you know what? I think we're going to see if research is done. And especially with more same-sex parents now who are raising children, those parents are really, really involved and very onto what they are reading and hearing and practicing. So we got to do a lot of research in that area. It's too early yet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's starting to be able to happen now.
Yeah. Yeah, there's out of the States, there's the National Longitudinal Lesbian Family Study, and they're looking at all sorts of things, but I don't remember seeing anything specific to attachment, so I'll have to relook at that
yeah.
and see if there's anything there around attachment in particular.
With same-sex...
With lesbian mothers in particular.
Well, but also with homosexual gay men mm-hmm. are also adopting children mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. And there's... You know what? I've recently been looking for material. Mm-hmm. There's nothing.
Yes.
Yeah, we're going to have to write it, I
yeah.
think. Actually, that's a thought.
There's another project for you.
There we go. Yeah, right.
So I want to wrap this up, Sally, and I want to say thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
It really helps locate attachment theory. It takes away, I think, some of the stigma around it's the mother's fault, or it's, you know, after year one, mm-hmm. there's nothing you can do.
And let me just comment on that piece a little bit more, because... you know, even when there is a depressed mother, maybe it grew out of, well, her own past, of course, but then she has postpartum depression, serious, at the birth of the child. But because there are two parents, most often, the other parent can come in, and that makes all the difference in the world, is if that child can develop what needs to develop with that parent while the mother is recovering. And then when the mother recovers, she then works very hard at repair. I must say repair, I haven't mentioned that, but disruption and repair, that paradigm is critical in attachment. As long as you can repair, and there's where the hope comes from, you can make a difference.
And would you say that opportunity to repair could also happen, worst case scenario, the child's removed from the home, so it could happen in foster care or an adopted family?
I think so, yes, definitely. And that's what, you know, people adopting nowadays are getting a lot more training than they ever got before. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I just heard of a person I know who's adopting a 4-year-old little boy. And she's going off to she did a number of courses with Children's Aid anyway, but now she's going off to a 12-week course where she and her husband are going to learn about attachment theory.
Wow. Thank you very, very much, Sally. I found this very informative and quite useful.
Very good. Thank you. And you have excellent questions.
Thank you.